CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Ameri, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. So today we would like to welcome Dr. Julia Harton to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Harton is an assistant professor in the School of Community and Regional Planning at UBC. So thank you for joining us today.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me.
So I guess just to start off, you know, I took a look at your educational background and, you know, it's quite the accomplishments. You know, you recently graduated in 2020 with a PhD from the University of Southern California. And I see you actually have like two bachelor's degrees, is that correct? And a master's.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So would you say that there was like a certain moment of your education or your personal life that led you to, you know, study in this field of like community planning?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's so my research area is in housing, and there's a little bit of a personal connection because I used to move around a lot. So I think at one point I counted I had lived in over 30 rental units by the time I was 24, I think. So, you know, a bit of a personal connection to moving and to housing and the importance of housing. And yeah, as you might have seen looking at my CV, I grew up in Germany. I did most of my education in Germany before I came to the US, and actually started out with a degree in economics, and then went to China for an exchange. And that pretty much changed the trajectory of my educational journey. But then also, you know, I went on doing a PhD on the topic, and now I'm teaching in this area too.
Excellent.
Yeah. What was about it that made that transition from like education to housing? What was it that you saw in China that really changed it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was studying in my undergrad in economics, and it was all very theoretical, you know, these kind of rational decision-making models with humans, you know, as these decision makers, everything very abstract. And I felt kind of, you know, a reduced representation of what it means to be a human, even though, you know, I had come to economics thinking it would be a social science. So I learn about social interactions and the marketplace in that case. But I felt like economics was teaching me about these things in a very abstract way. And then when I went to China in 2010, first for an exchange, it was, you know, the growth, economic growth and urbanization was just so striking to experience there. I was in Shanghai and during the time of the expo, the World Expo, and, you know, buildings were just built at record speed, and things were changing so much. There were very poor people living next to very rich people. A lot of things that you learn about in theory that I could just experience firsthand, and made me so curious about, you know, learning these things from a more holistic point of view, not just you know, abstracting of from human interaction in the economic world. And so that's when I found out about planning, and city planning is much more about, again, it's a social science. It's about learning how people interact, and in this case, in the city. But it's taking, you know, the human as a full being, being with spatial experiences, visual experiences, experiences of belonging, a much more holistic account of how people interact. And so, yeah, I would say seeing it firsthand really made me want to change that if looking at the world.
I noticed you had a huge interest in low-end shared housing in China. Could you describe what exactly that means and what the sort of what it looked like?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just like compared to what it looks like in Vancouver, where it's like sharing an apartment with a roommate.
Yeah, exactly. So I had shared with roommates before myself, but yeah, as you're saying or alluding to, in much more low density situations. So yeah, in the Western context, we might be used to sharing maybe an apartment, but you have your own room, or maybe you're even sharing a room with one other person. But the situation I studied for my dissertation and I published on a little bit now. Is one where people share apartments and rooms with strangers in at a much larger scale. So you would think at least four people sharing a room, up to 50 people sharing a three-bedroom apartment, much, much higher densities of what we might think about when we hear the term shared housing. And yeah, I studied this during my dissertation research. It was surprising to find, and so I studied this in Shanghai, downtown Shanghai. And these were regular apartments, maybe that is similar to Vancouver or the Western context. From the outside, you can't really tell that people are sharing an apartment. They're just interspersed with regular rental units. The neighbors might not know about this, but in this case, of course, it's many, many more people sharing and living like that. And so surprising to find there's a lot of negotiation and obfuscation tactics going into hiding this phenomenon because this kind of density is illegal. And yeah, even local residents didn't know about it. And so it was a really exciting research to do to figure out why this is happening. What does it look like? What does it take? How does it feel to live like this? Yeah, I started publishing on that now. So there's a couple of articles out.
That's pretty interesting. Now I understand you actually went into live in one of these shared units for a certain period of time. Is that correct?
Yeah, so yes, I first found out about this online. So similar to Craigslist in China, there's also websites where people post about units for rent. In this case, it was just beds for rent. So there was actually at the time on the kind of Chinese Craigslist equivalent, there would be a category for bed spaces for rent. And so I actually started learning about this phenomenon online, seeing these thousands of ads for just beds for rent. And so I started by scraping these advertisements and systematically analyzing the information in there. Often they would have different prices depending on how many people would share a room, information about the location. So I could get a sense of what this phenomenon might look like. But then I went to actually go see these places. So I hired some local students in China and we did some site visits. So just called up the numbers that were listed in these rental ads and then pretended to be interested in renting a bed and actually go there to be able to see how does the information online compare to what you actually find when you go there. And pretty quickly it became clear that these places were much more crowded than what I would see online and or what was suggested online with the pictures and the kind of ads information that was provided. And so I decided to collect another set of data through these site visits. So systematically, again, we visited a bunch of places and took down the information kind of in a similar way to what would be provided online. And then you could kind of compare those two data points. And pretty much the main message was that the places were much more crowded, usually a little more expensive, and usually in a little bit of a different place than the address provided online, again, probably because these are illegal. But then I also wanted to understand not only, what's the price and where are these places and how crowded they get. I also wanted to understand why people live like this and how does it feel to do that. So these kinds of things you can't address with quantitative data. And so I decided to do interviews with current and former bed space renters. And then at the very end of my field work, I was able to actually rent a bed myself for roughly 2 weeks.
Excellent. Thank you for taking the time to share that. We'll be right back here on CITR 101.9 FM with Research Review after just a few short messages. So please stay tuned.
You're listening to Spill Tap, a musical artist who grabs disparate feelings, sounds, tones, and textures and pieces them together in a patchwork of lo-fi alternative pop bliss. Spill Tap will be performing in Vancouver on September 15th at the Fox Cabaret. See you there.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we've been interviewing Dr. Julia Harton, an assistant professor in the School of Community and Regional Planning at UBC. So far we've talked about how Dr. Harton got into the area she is researching now and a bit about her work in China's shared rental market, some of the research she's done in that area, and some of the experience she also has in that area about the low-end shared housing market in urban Chinese cities. How was the experience of like renting a bed? Were they like hesitant since you were like a foreigner, you know, to rent a bed? Were they surprised to see you coming there or not?
Yeah, it was really difficult. So yeah, you know, by the time I was trying to rent myself, the website had evolved. So there was an app now, and you were able to not only contact the landlords through phone, but you could also chat with them. And I do write Chinese, so I was able to kind of chat with them and say I'm interested, and they would say, sure, just come by, just one question, a little bit about your background. And as soon as I told them that I'm not Chinese, it was just basically the ghosted the conversation would end there, which makes sense because, I mean, again, these really crowded places are not legal. And so having someone that looks very different, you know, enter, like, be seen there, draws attention. And so, you know, that's not something that you want when you're operating in illegal dormitory housing. So it took a very long time to find a landlord that was willing to rent to me.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And one question about the whole like legality. So, you know, of course it is illegal, but how is it enforced? Is this something that, you know, it's very strict enforcement? So if they find out, they would come shut down the place, or is this something that the authorities don't really care about, or they kind of like turn a blind eye towards it?
It's kind of both ends, I would say. So there's some enforcement. It was tricky to figure out what exactly the government attitude was. Because in China, the government, I mean, as in many places, is very multi-layered. And there is a sort of a very small unit government, which is called the Zhiweihui. It's the kind of unit or block unit government, kind of the interface with people, with local residents. And so they're kind of in charge of enforcing this. And they're also in charge of taking complaints from other residents. And I found out that in some cases they knew about it. In other cases, they actively wanted to know about these things, and they were, you know, more aggressive with enforcement. But there were also places where they, you know, definitely knew about it, and there would be some kind of raids just for show to appease the complaining neighbors, and then the landlords would just come back in. So one landlord told me that he has these special made bunk beds, because, you know, bunk beds are necessary if you want to maximize space use, but they're special made because they're cheap wood and they're small, and when they get destroyed during a raid, you can just, for very little money, order new ones and get them set up within hours again. So a lot of strategizing goes into that whole dealing with the legal illegality.
Interesting. And one last question before, you know, Gurman comes in. Who are the landlords? Are they just like individuals who are purchasing these as investment properties, or are these larger corporations? How do they operate?
Yeah, so at the time when I was doing the research, it was mostly actually also migrant families. So in China, there's a pretty big divide between local residents and migrants in terms of the rights that you have, and also in terms of these, all interact to produce different housing outcomes between locals and migrants. So these landlords would actually be leasing from, renting from the original owners that you know, usually don't even know what's happening in their properties. And they sign long-term rental contracts, and then these migrant families sublease the beds, and the difference between the rent that they pay to the owner and the all the money they make from renting out the individual beds is basically their profit. And so yeah, it's a business that was sometimes operated at scale with like a big migrant family having multiple properties under their management. And sometimes it was just people seizing the opportunity, because at the time the demand for this type of housing was so great that I saw places like, you know, a former pet store turned into a bed rental. Just the storage unit of another business is renting out that room with beds. So all kinds of spaces turned into bed space rentals just because the demand was there.
Interesting.
Yeah. When you mention migrants, do you mean migrants from more rural areas or foreign countries?
So they're internal migrants, but many of the ones that I interviewed or that I saw when I did the site visits were actually not necessarily rural migrants. So they were educated, you know, college graduates, sometimes from other cities, smaller cities. Sometimes they were rural, from a rural background, but because, again, there's this thing in China called a hukou, which is the kind of household registration system, which heavily influences your access to a lot of resources, including education. And so it's really difficult for, or it's much more difficult for students of rural backgrounds to actually get into higher education. So a lot of students or college graduates are actually urban migrants. But yeah, so they would come from other cities, from universities to Shanghai to start work there. They would pretty much all be entry-level young urban professionals.
Is the market in those smaller cities so bad that you would have to go to a 15-person shared rental unit to find work?
No, but... okay, yeah, this is a very good question, but I guess Shanghai offers different types of opportunities, right? So it's about the long-term payoffs of forging a career in a place like Shanghai, which has a lot of international companies, a lot of headquarters of domestic companies in Shanghai, so much higher density of really high opportunity jobs and career prospects. And of course, yes, there is a big difference in wages, interregional difference in wages. So the wages in Shanghai would be much, much higher than in a smaller city. So it yes, it's definitely a sort of sacrificing, but it's a sacrificing not because there are no other opportunities, but for the longer term prospects that working in Shanghai and establishing a career in Shanghai would give you.
So do these people have quite a bit of social mobility, or do you find that they're just living there for years on end?
No, the hope is the hope is social mobility. So that's what I mean by longer term prospects. So there's a pretty you know, established literature that documents how working in big cities actually affects your long term wage development a lot. And intuitively, I guess people know this, that if you get into a high paying job at the beginning of your career, that kind of sets you on a different trajectory, right? And so, yeah, the hope is to sacrifice a little to be able to get into one of these better career trajectories. What I found is that most of them did not live in like the very crowded settings for very long. So it was really a way to bridge this a little bit precarious transition from college graduate into the job market, specifically because of transition in the education system in China, which gave a lot more people access to higher education, but also lowered the signaling power of higher education degrees. And so in turn, companies kind of lowered the payment. A lot of companies have entry positions have lowered payments. So there's a trial period with reduced wages. And it's exactly that period that people are trying to bridge using the group rentals.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message. So please stay tuned.
Interested in making radio? How about hosting your own show? At CITR, you can make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From news, art, sports, to gender empowerment, accessibility, music, and the BIPOC collective, there's definitely something for everyone. Explore new worlds both virtually and at our station, and be prepared to have a blast with some new pals. For more information or to join, please visit citr.ca/get involved.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Julia Harton, an assistant professor in the School of Community and Regional Planning at UBC. And so far, we've been talking primarily about Dr. Harton's research on the topic of China's shared rental markets, specifically the low-end shared housing situation in urban Chinese cities. So I think, Gurman, you had a question to ask.
Yeah, changing subjects a little bit. You mentioned earlier raids. How common are those, and what do those look like?
Sorry, could you say
that again? Like raids of the apartment by the police?
Oh, yeah. Again, it depends. There were sort of, you know, there's like a different housing types that are more susceptible to having group rentals in them. So again, imagine that you have to hide this activity for it to happen or to be, to exist, right? And so in urban China, most of the housing is organized in residential towers, and the residential towers will be grouped and into gated communities. So there's different sizes. Sometimes it's just two towers. Sometimes it's 14 towers, and they're sort of surrounded by a fence and with multiple entry points that are guarded. And so, you know, a bigger place with 14 towers, of course, offers much more anonymity than a place with just two towers, just because of the amount of residents and the guards not really being able to know everyone. So in smaller places, maybe where also the neighbors are more vigilant, they know each other, the raids could be happening more often, and eventually that would lead to no group rentals or very few group rentals in those types of housing. But in other types, it would maybe not be so common. So it really depends on the kind of spatial setting and also on the relationship of the landlords with the guards and the Jiuweihui.
Yeah, you mentioned that the landlords would be buying very cheap beds in case they get broken during a raid. Like, do these raids get very like physical?
Yeah, so as I said, like some of these raids are kind of for show, to appease the other homeowners in the compounds. So you know, to do something about it. So then, you know, they would be violent in the sense that the property gets destroyed, and they would be sometimes, you know, visited some places at just after raids. There would be banners outside of the buildings displaying pictures as evidence from the raids, with the police as officers, you know, inspecting, and you know, warning language. If you see something, reported to the police, this kind of thing. So it would be very heavily publicized as a means to, you know, either as a means to appease the ones that are bothered, and, or also as a deterrent to such activity in the future.
Now, one question I have is, you know, just out of like curiosity, because I'm wondering, when you have, say, like 10 people living in the same room, how do things like using a kitchen, cooking, eating, going to the washroom, like changing your clothes, how do these things like work on a daily basis?
Yeah. So I just want to say I did experience it myself, but I want to say that my experience is probably or almost definitely very different from people that actually live there, right? I was doing this on a short-term basis, and definitely, I was doing this not working 10 hours in an office at the same time. So I just want to say I had a very different experience from people that actually live there. What I can say is that most of the time the kitchen would be either convert it into another bedroom or a storage area. So there's no cooking. A lot of times they don't allow cooking because of the fire hazard. There were several cases where fires broke out in group rentals and people have died because they couldn't get out in time. So cooking is usually not allowed. The bathroom use is an issue. So the place I stayed in was a two-bedroom apartment with 22 women and just one bathroom. So you can imagine it's quite a few women sharing just one bathroom. In China, maybe a little more, but you know, similarly to other countries, there's expectations about how women look and so or have to look. So, you know, there's grooming and washing and makeup and hair and all these things to take care of. And so what I found in my research actually doing the quantitative analysis too is that women tend to pay more to be in less crowded environments so that they could actually fulfill these expectations and do their jobs that require them to appear with certain appearances.
Would it also be harder to find one of those spaces as a woman?
Yeah, so what I found looking at the online advertisements is that a very small fraction of the online advertisements actually said that they were renting to women only. So within that shared rental category on the website that I used, there was a required field to fill in, which asked the lister to specify if it was a shared mixed gender, man only or women only apartment. And I think it was something like 2 or 3% of the ads were actually advertised as being for women only. But I did see quite a few more all women apartments in the site visits, which usually were shown upon request. So it seems that they're not visible online in the same way, perhaps because women tend to search more through social networks. I also experienced that a lot of the landlords didn't really want to deal with female tenants because there was this expectations that managing an apartment full of women is much more complicated than managing an apartment full of men because of drama and fights over the bathroom and whatnot. So yeah, it seems there were multiple factors at play that would suggest that maybe women looked for these apartments in different ways. I can't really say what the real ratio of all female mixed gender and men only apartments were at the time.
Now, one question is going. Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Okay. Just going back quickly. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You brought up an interesting point with just like the drama in like bathrooms potentially like happening. I know that's like one stereotype. I would imagine that like anyone living in a 15 room apartment, regardless of gender, that in a small apartment is basically just like a boiling pot, like a pressure play, just like ready to explode. Do you ever feel like anger, outbursts, fights ever happen in those small cramped places where it's really easy to get angry?
Yeah, not so much in the one that I'm staying at. I mean, there's several things. So first of all, because most of them are university graduate or college graduates. Actually, student housing in China is mostly dorms as well, so a shared dorms. So the typical undergrad student dorm would be a 6-bed room. So you already used to sharing a room with 6 other people, right? So that's one thing that kind of prepares you for living very tight. And they're not that big either. I visited a couple of student dorms. They're also pretty cramped. Of course, then, you know, on campus, you still have lots of other kind of semi-private spaces where you can hang out and you have more space. In these rental apartments, I mean, every space is taken up by either stuff or beds. So there's no other furniture in these places, right? Like no tables, no chairs. You sit on your bed, basically. If you're not in the bathroom, then you have to be in your bed. There's no other really other place to be. And so and then a lot of them work a lot, so, and then try to stay outside as well to not spend as much time. So there a lot of things go into managing this kind of living, trying to just not be there when you're there, trying to, you know, maybe have earphones in and watch TV or anything that doesn't, you know, let you experience where you are physically with your body. I do think the fact that a lot of them come from student dormitory experiences, they're already used to sharing very little space with people that you did not choose and that can be annoying. Once I asked the women in my room, you know, how is it to live like this? And what they said was, it's very inconvenient. So, you know, for me, as I said, I mean, there's a difference between how I experienced this with my sort of prior experiences and my context. But for me, that would be a word very far down the list to describe this kind of living situation. And they basically said, yeah, it's very inconvenient. You know, you have nowhere to put your stuff, you can't cook. But, you know, no stronger words than that was used. So, quite remarkable.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message. So please stay tuned.
Come see punk rock band McLusky at the Rickshaw Theater on September 22nd. Check out www.rickshawtheater.com for more details.
Now, you know, one question I have is, like, you know, kind of like connecting this to like the Canadian or the, you know, the Western experience is that, you know, I've noticed like increasingly, you know, some like questionable shared housing arrangements have become more common in Vancouver and Canada, definitely not to the degree that, you know, you saw in your research. But one example is, like, I saw a news article a few weeks ago about so-called bed rental going on near the University of Waterloo, which is in Ontario, where a landlord had basically was advertising 4 beds in one bedroom. So 4 people living in one bedroom, which is very unusual here to advertise that sort of living arrangement, and charging around like $300 a month or $350 a month, which is significantly less than what a regular rental would cost. And, you know, of course, like, this was like in the news, it was pretty shocking. It was like pretty illegal because it's not something that we see every day here. But do you think these sort of like living arrangements might become more common, whether it is here in like Canada or other countries, especially like from an economic perspective?
Yeah, yes. So I think even though the kind of the specific social forces that produce people that might need these very low income housing opportunities and might be able to also tolerate them are very specific to China, the general trend of young people kind of sacrificing to be able to live in big cities because that's where the jobs and opportunities are, I think, is, and the general trend also for the transition from graduating from college into stable employment being more and more precarious, I think, is a global trend. And so, you know, actually when I gave a talk to get the job I'm in today, what I did was I prepared a slide with headlines from countries or from cities and countries around the world. And it's, you can pretty much any big city, London, New York, Sydney, Mumbai, Tokyo, you can, LA, you can find an example of this kind of thing happening in the news. And we always know, you know, the news catches that one case, but usually there's more than one.
Yeah.
Yes, I do think this is unfortunately a global trend, mostly because the way that our economy has changed to be predominantly knowledge and service based, this type of economic activity is uniquely tied to density. So in the future, more and more of the jobs will be in cities. And so more and more people will have to get to cities, be in cities. And I don't think a lot of the city planning is actually up for the challenge right now.
One question I have, like, just out of curiosity, I don't know if you looked into this, but about the whole, like, jobs being in city, because, like, right now these days we're seeing, like, a lot more online jobs, a lot of, like, work from home jobs. Are you thinking, you know, for example, not just like in the case in China, but like even like here or other places, would having more jobs online help alleviate this? For example, people wouldn't have to like move from rural areas to crowd into the cities to be able to access these sort of employment opportunities.
So my opinion on this is that two things. First of all, I don't think that I think for a lot of jobs, they cannot be permanently fully online. I don't think the morale and kind of motivation that we need, especially for these knowledge intensive jobs where companies need to retain skilled professionals, I don't think the kind of loyalty and motivation and morale to keep up with a job can be sustained long term if it's only a remote relationship. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and related to that, is that, you know, as I said earlier, there's a pretty big literature establishing that people learn by working in big cities. So they learn from interacting with other people and being able to switch jobs quickly because there's many opportunities in their fields. And the best example of that is the kind of hubs, right? Like the Silicon Valley. The reason that there's a reason that all these companies put up with like how very high housing costs for their employees, very high, you know, land rents for their own company headquarters. It is because there's something about being close to each other with other leading tech companies that's actually making them successful. And so I don't think there's remote work can help us get away from
that. Definitely. I agree with that, you know, because I think at the beginning of the pandemic, like 2020, there was a lot of like articles about like remote work is the future. But now we're going back to like a lot of companies, jobs are going back like either partially or fully in person. And like one interesting thing I saw was that in 2020, there was a large like exodus like of people moving out of it was New York City. So rents were going down, housing became a little bit more affordable. But right now, actually, the opposite had happened. It's apparently the highest rent in history, like I think like $5,000 for a one bedroom, that sort of thing going on. So obviously, like, again, we're seeing like people going back to these hubs, going back to these cities, looking for those sort of opportunities.
Yeah, and I think right in the middle of the pandemic, it was either, I think it's Facebook or Google, I might be confusing the two, but one of them signed the lease for a whole city block of offices in New York City, right in the heart of New York City. So even, you know, then they already knew this was going to be temporary.
Yeah.
One question I would have to wrap things up is, what sort of proposal for a solution would you have for these young recent graduates and the housing problems they face? Like, is there anything we can do to help them live in more humane conditions?
I started this research in 2016, so almost 6 years ago. And a lot has changed, as always in China, you know, change is very fast. I started the scraping and the first site visits in 2016. And then I came back in 2018 to do the interviews and actually in one of these places. And already in those 2 years, the landscape had changed quite a bit. So it was much harder to find rentals. There were much fewer of them, it seems. The website did not have that category anymore. And one big thing that had happened between 2016 and 18 was that in 2017, the Beijing government or the national government set population caps for Beijing and Shanghai population growth caps. So now there was a big new incentive to enforce this type of rental housing to be able to control and comply with these population growth caps. Another thing that happened during the same time is that I think the issue of these recent college graduates, which are actually from, you know, from the local government perspective in China, those were so-called desirable city residents, even though they may not have local hukou, which is usually sort of the kind of justification for any policy intervention to help people. Even though they may not have a local hukou, they're highly skilled, they're young, they contribute to the economy, so it's actually highly desirable for them to be in the city and for the government to support them being in the city. So there was a push again around 2016, 2017 to form companies that would kind of step into this role of sub-landlords, take investment properties and turn them into rental properties, shared rental properties, but at much lower density. And they would do it at scale to be able to house the same amount of people. So, you know, already a couple of years ago, the rental landscape shifted a bit in the sense that there was a real recognition of the problem and also a recognition of the economic opportunity to get into rental housing, which wasn't a really big deal in urban China before 2017. And so now with these kind of semi-professional managed suits, there's other opportunities now. It's still crowded, but you'd share with two people or you share with three people, and you might even be able to afford your own room. So different levels of crowding, much more similar to maybe what we would think of crowding or shared rentals in the Western context. So yeah, I think that could teach us that it takes recognition of the problem. And I'm not sure, you know, the problem hasn't gotten as bad in the Western context, but I am also not sure if there is a recognition of this kind of problem, this kind of newly vulnerable subpopulations.
Definitely.
Are not recognized yet.
I feel like this is something like here, at least in Vancouver, I'm seeing like it's starting to emerge, like the housing issue, and it's something that if action is not taken right now, you know, it could get worse, you know.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've seen a couple of articles that actually this year it seems that student housing is much, much bigger of an issue than it has been in previous years.
Definitely, yeah.
So, you know, that might get some attention.
Yeah, so it's, but definitely it's been great having you on the show today, being able to talk about your experiences, the research you've done. It's very unique. So we appreciate the perspective you've brought in. You know, it's pretty exciting that now that you're at UBCC, what else it is that you can be working on, what the next research you have. Maybe we'll have you back on again.
Yes, I definitely have a couple of projects in the work. I'm looking at shared housing in Los Angeles, and I have another project on rental housing discrimination, gender-based rental housing discrimination in India, working on some stuff in Vancouver too. So yes, I'll be happy to come back in a couple of years.
Excellent.
Totally. Yeah, the whole thing just looked like a great documentary to me when I was just reading your research.
I'm glad. It's always great to hear that people think it's interesting what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And that was our interview with Dr. Julia Harton, an assistant professor in the School of Community and Regional Planning at UBC. We hope you tune in again to Research Review 2 weeks from now on Wednesday at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.